He has written 4 novels, 3 books of essays, and several articles and essays for magazines. He's also written a play entitled Blues for Mr. Charlie. He spent the last year in Hollywood writing the script for the play The Life of Malcolm X. He has been a Paxton Fellow, a Rosenwald Fellow, a Guggenheim Fellow, and a Partisan Review Fellow. In 1956, he received an award from the National Institute of Awards and Letters. I could go on and on citing his achievements, but my husband told me not to talk too long. So without further ado, I'd like you to meet our guest lecturer for tonight. He is black and he is beautiful, Mr. James Baldwin.
Can you all hear me up there? I don't really have a speech. I'm not going to talk very long. What I thought we would do is I would talk a little while, and then we would have, then you can ask me questions, and we can have a kind of dialogue or happening or a ball. And since I am really not able to write speeches or to read them, I always have to sort of play it by ear. I know what I have in my mind, and I'm very curious to know what you have on your minds. And so we'll kick it off quite arbitrarily, mentioning 2 things at once. Then I am supposed to be, the title of my lecture is supposed to be How Long? A title agreed on months and months ago when I did not know what I was going to talk about and when I was miles and miles away. But it brings to mind what I will call an old English proverb. It is a definition of the power of what was once the British Empire. And the old English proverb is divide and rule. We live in a country which is under the extraordinary illusion that what has happened in other countries and in other civilizations and to other people cannot happen here. Although we have seen kingdoms decline and fall, though we have heard of Rome, though we have heard of Carthage, though we know that there was a day in the history of the world when Turkey was a great, great power, and though we have watched the decline and fall of France and the history of the Third Reich, and in spite of the fact that the country is populated in the main by people who come from vanished kingdoms and crumbling empires, we yet suppose that there is some magic, some voodoo on the North American continent, which makes us exempt from all these rules, from the rules, in fact, of power and the loss of power, the rules of life and death, the rules of birth and love. Now, I'm speaking to you arbitrarily and obviously as a descendant, as a product of the only valid witnesses this country has ever really had as to its real condition. I am speaking to you as a great-grandson of a slave. When the American Republic had what it calls its revolution, it was a revolution carried out by exiles from Europe, and the price of the revolution, as it turned out, the price of the country, as it turned out, was the slaughter of the indigenous population and the enslavement of the blacks. Not so very long ago, I was reading a book called Slavery Defended, a series of speeches by Southern senators not 1,000 years ago. One of the speeches, for example, explained that Virginia, which was a slave-producing state, that is to say, it produced slaves for other states, other cities. It sold its slaves. And the slavery could not be abolished in Virginia, because if it were, there would be no Virginia. The connection between the state of Virginia, the textile mills in Manchester, and the state of Connecticut, in fact, the entire Western world, depended on, for a very long time, and it remained until the day it depends on, the enslavement of the non-white peoples of this world. That is what we really mean when we talk about the American economy. That is what Eisenhower meant when he said, if we lose Southeast Asia, we will lose the tungsten, the tin, the minerals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and so forth, on which we depend. But those things are obvious. I mention those things now to get to something else. When I say I'm addressing you as a great-grandson of a slave, I'm not being rhetorical about it. And it would not be important that I'm addressing you as that great-grandson if my condition were not, until this very hour, in 1969, carried in two places. One is on my brow, and the other is in the American heart, and in all of the American institutions, every single one of them, from the schools to the labor unions to the churches, until today, until this hour, there are very few white people in this country who have the remotest notion of what a black man or woman or child endures in what we used to call the land of the free and the home of the brave. And that is not so important as the fact that my countrymen, this sovereign people, these liberated pilgrims, pretend not to know what they know too well. We are leading now in this country, aren't we? Abominable lives. From the president of any union you want to name, to any southern senator you want to name, the mayors of all cities in this country, to the students, who according to me are our only hope. One is in the extraordinary position of having watched, in my own case certainly, for more than 20 years, a procession of politicians, elected to seats of power. Seats of power in this country means global power. Used car salesmen, elected by a sovereign people to preserve what they call law and order. Now, you have to consider very seriously, and I don't know how to make you understand this. You have to understand that I, for example, who am a more or less law-abiding citizen, I don't break the law insofar as I can help it. I observe traffic signs. I have never threatened a cop. You must understand that this citizen, nevertheless, watches day in and day out, and from generation to generation, not his life only, but his father's life, his mother's life, his uncle's life, his brother's life, his sister's life. All of them law-abiding citizens. All of them. And watches his children's life, his niece's life, his nephew's life. All of them law-abiding citizens. And observes how little the country respects law and order if you are powerless. Now, what the country means when it says, I should obey the law, is that I should ignore, for example, watching a cop in Harlem being paid off by the pimp and the prostitute and the junkie and the pusher. That I should be so blind as not to know that when they tear down buildings, not only in Harlem, all over this country, in every city, when they begin the process they call urban renewal, there's always one thing left standing, the liquor store. That I am so stupid that I don't know that if oil were discovered in Harlem tomorrow, the black people would not get rich. We are talking about a winter of discontent which has lasted for 400 years. In Jamestown in 1619, when I arrived on this alabaster continent, there were no communists. When I was picking the cotton and lining the track and singing Steal Away to Jesus, I had not heard of Moscow. And now, my friends, because it has been born in on a certain segment of the populace, white and black, that there is something rotten in the state of which we are a part. They've answered white students the way they've always answered me, with guns, with bayonets, tanks, with helicopters. This is an interest, you will observe, of protecting the rights of a free people to be educated. And you will furthermore, hopefully, consider what the American concept of education would mean to Ronald Reagan when he was young, and what it means to me. You will ask yourselves, If there is such a ferment, if no one was overcome with moral indignation at the beginning, let us say, of Richard Nixon's career, and I hope you all remember, though you may be too young to remember, that there was also in this country, not a long time ago, a very celebrated senator named Joseph McCarthy from Wisconsin. And Nixon was one of his friends. And to go no further than that, if no one in the country has ever been upset by Senator Eastland, by Governor Wallace, by McNamara, by General Westmoreland, by the overkill, underkill, by that dirty little war, that dirty little racist war, if we have not been upset by that, it is late in the day to blame the blacks, the young, and the students for being dissidents. The question to ask is what they are dissenting from. Perhaps it has been born in on some white people and some black people. There are other ways to live. Perhaps it is not necessary to live, to slaughter so many people. Perhaps the American power, which was based on slaughter, the Western power, the Christian power, the capitalist power, which has been based on piracy and murder, perhaps the time has come that some people in this country recognize that the slave trade has not corrupted me so much as has corrupted my masters. There's a great gap in this country in lifestyles. There is a lifestyle of a man like me, or a man like Malcolm, a man like Ray Charles, a woman like Billie Holiday, a woman like Bessie Smith, and the lifestyles of those curious people who live in Westchester and Beverly Hills. It's a very serious matter when in the same country, the co-citizens of the country no longer know what the other is talking about. And it seems to be very difficult for white Americans to understand that whereas they had the swimming pools in Beverly Hills, for example, I had to go there to wash the dishes and throw out the garbage and then go back to Watts. That I, who live in Harlem, work downtown, I know the difference between my kitchen and Mr. Charlie's kitchen. I know why my mother is in that kitchen and not in mine. I, speaking now as Sambo, the historical creation of the American Republic, have always had to look at my co-citizens who never thought of themselves as being my co-citizens, but as in some mysterious way my superiors, though they could not live without me. I have had to deal with you, watch you, listen to you, wash your children's diapers, cook your food, raise you. Deal with you from the time that I knew anything. And the great gap I speak of is that whereas this is true for me, and you cannot surprise me in any way whatever, I am so full of surprises for you that as the 20th century nears its end, well-meaning, serious people who have never heard of labor unions, churches, cities, schools, and what happens to children in those schools. Well-meaning, serious American citizens say to me, for example, why are you so antagonistic? And what does the Negro want? My dear, we are the inheritors of a very strange and difficult history. The Europeans who came here did not leave Europe and have not left Europe yet. They dragged with them across the ocean the plague called white supremacy. They dragged with them across the ocean the extraordinary assumption that my gods of wood and stone were less valuable than their gods of wood and stone. That my blood sacrifices were pagan, but theirs were holy. They dragged across the ocean an image of a suffering Christ whom they, be it remembered, murdered. And made a cult of that, and a legend of that, and armed with the gun, forced me to bow down before that bloody altar. I repeat that what has happened to Sambo here, since it is clearer to Sambo than it is to others, it is not so serious as what has happened to Sambo's masters. It is because of that enormous defection, that extraordinary pretense that a man was a mule, could be bred like a mule and sold like a mule, to make states like Virginia and Connecticut rich. He could be baptized and become a Christian, but he was still ordained by God Almighty, according to the Christian Church, to be a slave forever. When we in Africa captured tribes and made them slaves, we did not pretend we were breaking in oxen. We knew the difference between a man and a mule. The people who have pretended for so long that my ancestors and my progeny are indistinguishable from chattel and have said to themselves this in the name of Jesus Christ and in order to make money, now find themselves in a very strange place. And the place is this. They don't any longer know who they are. And what they did to my children is now beginning to be done to their children. And whereas not 1,000 years ago, the only people being beaten up in America, as far as we could tell, the only people on the needle, the only people dying of an overdose, were black kids, right? And later on, little, you know, Puerto Ricans. And nobody cared. Every Saturday night on Catfish Row, the niggers were supposed to beat themselves, each other to death, cut each other's throats, and nobody cared. And now, because nobody cared, it has moved from Lenox Avenue to Westchester. It has moved from Watts to Beverly Hills. There's not a single American city at this very hour where anyone is safe. The fabric of this country, which has always been menaced by the lie central to this country, is beginning to come apart. Because, in fact, nobody believes any longer what they thought they believed. When I was little, and I was asked to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, I was only 5 or 6 years old, but it stuck in my throat. I never mastered it. But now many other people, not black, are beginning to wonder about that pledge and whether it is honorable. Honorable. To have a black boy born in a ghetto, somehow he gets to be 17 years old. He has no job. He's got no morale. He's got no future. He's a bad nigger, a dangerous cat, so you put him in the army. And you send him overseas to fight for freedom. You put a gun in his hand to liberate other people who've never called him nigger. And then, if he survives, you're going to bring him back. And he still has no school. And he still has no job. And he still has no future. You bring him back and pat him on the head, put him back in the ghetto and say, be nice. It'll be better tomorrow. Who's tomorrow? And how long? It is the kind of immorality, to use an old-fashioned term. It is a depth of an immorality which no civilization can hope to survive. There is no way for this country to make me make peace with my condition. And it doesn't do any good for all this country's big daddies to say, we got the guns, we got the tanks, we got the helicopters, you're only one-tenth of a nation, who cares? You've always had the guns, the tanks, and the robes, the rope, the knife, the law, the judges, the jury. I know a lot about white power. It's a great mistake to assume that when a level of discontent comes what has come in America, that you're going to save the state by hiring as governors and policemen various broken-down movie stars. They believe their movies. And so did the great American Republic. No. There is trouble in this land. It is not for nothing. It is not for nothing that our cities have looked like Harlem for so long. I was born in Harlem nearly 45 years ago. And I have lived long enough to see all of New York City look just like Harlem. I will even mention Washington, D.C., the capital of this great nation. I spent a long time lately in Hollywood, where they think the trees and the lawns and the Japanese gardeners will protect them. Hollywood is the city which faces Tokyo. It is no answer. When black students, for example, demand an Afro-American studies program, a black student union, everyone misunderstands the nature of the plea, the nature of the demand. The nature of the demand is not so much that I want to learn about the great empires of Egypt. If I'm demanding a black studies program, I know about those. I want to have my history honored in the country which I paid for. I want to have it recognized at long last that there would be no America if it had not been for me. White people in this country have to recognize that without that black back, they would not be here. They would not be here. I dare anyone within the sound of my voice to investigate the economy of any single state in this union and discover on what that economy is based. Now, it is simply not possible, not even in the name of Jesus Christ, for me to continue to pick the sugar cane for you, dig up the diamonds for you, smelt the tin for you. It is no longer possible for me to give away my life, the only life I have, to make you rich. And furthermore, even if I don't say so, even if no one says so, everybody knows that a day is coming in Johannesburg, South Africa, when those poor men in the mines will not go down to the mines anymore. Not for the West. It is perfectly true, and people are endlessly pointing it out to me, that the East is worse. It's hard to frighten a frightened man, though. That this particular system is the best system the world has ever seen. But my father would not have agreed with him. My mother doesn't still. My nephew is dubious. It is perfectly true that we are about to go through some extraordinary metamorphosis, knowing and see what the end will be. But it is also perfectly true that the system of spiritual and economic exploitation of other human beings for profit. It is also true that that has had its hour, has had its day. What we, the white and black, in this most curious country, this country which has not become a country yet, which sees nothing strange in calling a black boy brother in Saigon and calling him nigger here, which does it every day without even knowing it. What we have to deal with, black and white, if we are serious, is a very simple fact. I think this is where this country is now. We have allowed many crimes to be committed in our names. This time, If you, the sovereign republic, if you, who elected Eisenhower to office not once but twice, and who now have a new contender for what throne? If you, this time, allow me, Sambo, to be carried away in the night, if you allow me, this time, to be burned, to be castrated, to be lynched, to be murdered, if you allow that to happen this time, it is not I who will go. You will have agreed what the Germans had to agree to in 1932, to turn not only Sambo into a concentration camp, but to turn this country into what we will then have to call the Fourth Reich. Ciao.